Our second case this morning is United States against Bagstad. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Major Anthony Burgos, and I represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Jason M. Bagstad. The appellant was convicted by a panel where two-thirds of the members had a senior-subordinate relationship. The sole issue before this court is whether the military judge abused his discretion in denying appellant's challenge against a senior member who not only was a reporting senior to another member, but also had a supervisory position over him. The specifics of the facts of this case place an intolerable strain on the public perception of the military justice system and failed implied bias tests, just as they did in U.S. v. Beeson. In fact, the situation here is more acute than was present in U.S. v. Beeson. Specifically, there were several reasons why, and specifically the lower court did not consider.
Firstly, counsel.
Yes, sir.
As I understand the facts, they had a colloquy over this. The judge denied a challenge. The defense then exercised a peremptory that got it down to these three members.
Yes,
correct?
Sir.
Okay. Why wasn't this issue waived by not removing the objection once you got to the final panel?
Well, Your Honor, it's the appellant's position that the relationship was problematic from the get-go, and as the numbers became smaller, it nonetheless became even more problematic, as it were. The trial defense counsel raised it, and the military judge didn't even address it on the record. And so it's appellant's position that he raised it, the military judge didn't, he invoked the implied bias,
liberal grant
mandate, however, didn't address the trial defense counsel's challenge for cause on this specific fact when we're talking about Captain Stoichka and Gunnery Sergeant Walston. So it's appellant's position that he didn't waive the issue. It's still alive before this court for that reason.
What's the record reflect about the unit in question? This is a transportation support company?
Yes, Your Honor. The only facts we have is obviously through the questionnaires.
Excuse me?
Through the questionnaires and the members' questionnaires, Your Honor.
Okay, well, what do we know then about this company?
The record
is... How many people in a transportation support company? Is that a fact that we're allowed to know, or can we only know it from the record?
Well, presumably only from the record, Your Honor. I mean, the problem becomes when we're talking about companies that not are line company, regular infantry units, probably the numbers could expand, not necessarily in the traditional sense of a company at that level. So the problem is the only information we have about this motor transport company, unfortunately, is in the members' questionnaires. And specifically, when we're speaking of the numbers, comparing USVs...
What about the rank makeup in a company? Is that something we can take judicial notice of? What it's comprised of as far as personnel?
I believe this court can, Your Honor. I mean, this is information that's a court can take judicial notice of the rank, the structure, the ranks of individuals, of the organizational structure of units, and specifically the Marine Corps, and in specific. Right along that question, Your Honor, is when we're talking about the company commander and that billet of the company gunnery sergeant. And so that's a billet that's unique to the Marine Corps. And so when we're speaking about the company gunnery sergeant, and that's the big factor, that's the big issue here that gets us in areas more acute than U.S. v. Beeson. The court recalls in U.S. v. Beeson we had several intertwining relationships. We had executive officers, we had sergeants major, we had battalion commanders, and so all senior-ranking individuals. And what we have here, then, is a company. We're at the company level. And what we have is a company gunnery sergeant. This billet is unique to the Marine Corps, as I said earlier. And what's so unique about it is this individual is entrusted with the good order and discipline of the company.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, I think probably we can take judicial notice of the actual rank structure, the existence of a company gunny. But can we take judicial notice of the import of that position without testimony?
Perhaps you can, Your Honor, and I'll illustrate it this way. When you look at the structure, it's important to point out that the company gunner, he's part of the company structure. He's part of that company command structure. And so he has, if we're looking at the structure, he falls beneath, immediately beneath would be the company commander. If there's a company executive officer, a company first sergeant, and we have the company gunnery sergeant. And so but the specifics, getting into the weeds of what he necessarily does day to day, it could vary from company to company. But I guess this court could take judicial notice of that billet of the company gunnery sergeant.
Well, are you saying that because he's in charge of good order and discipline, he would have been subject to a challenge for cause?
Perhaps he could, Your Honor. The problem, again, is the issue of his relationship with the company commander. It was addressed simply in the questionnaires and only when he raised the reporting senior analysis. When he raised the issue that he was his reporting senior, the question then is, why is that? And so we move on to the fact that the company gunner sergeant was his immediate, felt directly beneath the company commander.
Can we decide this case your way, consistent with Murphy? Or is the proposition that superior-subordinate relationships are not per se bad, still good law?
They're not per se bad, Your Honor. And that's the problem is, as this Court has pointed out, it's a contextual argument. You look at all the facts of the case. And pushing aside the billet issue, if Gunnery Sergeant Walston was just a gunnery sergeant in his motor transport company, and again, we don't know the numbers, but assuming he's one of 50 gunnery sergeants, and the company commander nonetheless was reporting senior, it becomes more problematic, it becomes even more dangerous. We're in dangerous ground as that gunnery sergeant is closer to the flagpole. In other words, his day-to-day working is closer to the flagpole, and that gets us into this really in the danger zone where...
How do you answer the argument that... Here you have company commander 03, a few years in Marine Corps. Here you have crusty old gunnery sergeant, extremely experienced, 50 tattoos and a whole bunch of years in the Marine Corps, and he's going to be overawed by this 03?
Well, that's an interesting argument, Your Honor, because here's the problem with that. The gunnery sergeant, who's been around the block once or twice, he understands the value of reporting fitness reports. He understands that this man, whether he's a lieutenant or captain, first lieutenant straight out of the basic school in Quantico, he holds the key, this individual, he or she holds the key to advancement in the future. And so he'd essentially be the gatekeeper for this gunnery sergeant's advancement.
Well, doesn't that argue for a per se rule of an exclusion of command relationships? Because that's present in any superior-subordinate relationship.
Perhaps there is, Your Honor, but I don't think a per se rule... I strongly suggest that we're not advocating a per se ruling. The problem becomes when we're looking at the specific facts of the case, we start getting closer to where implied bias becomes.
You seem to be arguing generically about superior-subordinate relationships, but go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor.
What should the trial judge have done when they challenged the person off, and also there are three members there? You got the captain, the company gunny, and the first sergeant. You're saying the military judge should have done something affirmatively at that point?
Perhaps a further inquiry would have been appropriate, Your Honor. I mean, it would have probably dispelled perhaps...
question, though. What's the answer to the question? Did the military judge err by sui sponte not picking up the challenge again or not? Because if he didn't err by not picking up the challenge again, then what's the issue?
Well, the judge is presumed to know the law, Your Honor. U.S. v. Beeson has been on the books for a while now, so he should...
So what you're arguing is then he should have affirmatively done something.
Yes, Your Honor.
What should he have affirmatively done?
Recognize the billet position here, and just as he struck Captain Pertinent, he should have, sua sponte, removed Captain Stoichkin from the panel.
Wasn't another alternative for him to give reasons for not doing so in light of Beeson?
Perhaps that's an alternative.
Does Beeson establish a per se rule?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
So, didn't the judge have the opportunity to explain why he would not apply Beeson?
He could, Your Honor, yes.
So he had two options then. One would be, he had three options, actually. One was to say nothing, which he did.
Yes, sir.
Second would have been to have struck the member. The third would have been to have retained the member and explained why under Beeson.
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically, as I mentioned previously, the numbers, where we're talking about the numbers, the distinction between U.S. v. Veasan and the case here at bar, the numbers are really telling here, whereas the senior member would only have to influence one member versus the six members that would potentially be subject to influence in U.S. v. Veasan. And as I said earlier, the unique billet of Gunnery Sergeant Walston is unique in that he is part of the company command structure. And so when looking at the implied bias standard, this becomes particularly problematic. Another issue that
I argue that company gunnies really care what their fitness report says.
You're arguing
a special relationship. Is that fair or not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear
the special relationship that's at issue or the fitness report that's at issue?
No, it's really a combination of both, Your Honor, because remember the problem we had in U.S. v. Veasan is they all the colonel wrote the fitness reports for several members.
Which is more important here, the special relationship, if any, between a company gunny and the CO or the fitness report?
Which is more problematic
from your standpoint? This gets back to the Murphy question. Is this a fitness report question, or is this a something more issue?
I believe what gets us into really problematic areas is the relationship itself, Your Honor, because just as this court, there is no per se rule against this fitness report rating senior problem scenario. The relationship, and we've always stressed from the beginning that this company gunnery sergeant, his immediate working relationship with the company gunners, with the company commander, made it more problematic.
But in terms of the special relationship as opposed to a senior subordinate relationship, what are you relying on in the record that we should intuit that from?
Well, perhaps I overstate. What I mean by special relationship, Your Honor, what actually means is
it's a senior subordinate relationship based on billet and rank.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And other than that, what is there in the record to suggest that there's a special relationship or that the company gunnery sergeant was somehow particularly likely or that the public would perceive it as being likely to be influenced by the presence of the captain on the panel?
There are no other facts other than where...
Than the fact that he was a company gunnery sergeant?
That he was a company gunnery sergeant, Your Honor. And another issue altogether that was not addressed by the lower court was that the convening authority in this case was the same convening authority from the first trial. This is a rehearing, and so when we're speaking of viewing this through the eyes of the public, it becomes the context of public perception. And a system where the commander, the convening authority, picks, he has a prosecutorial discretion to pick the members and essentially say, we want to have a retrial. And so, viewed through the eyes of the public, this starts to look like the convening authority is perhaps stacking the deck against the appellant.
So does that go to the composition of the entire panel?
Perhaps it could, Your Honor.
But the fact that it was re-referred by the same convening authority, I'm not sure what that has, what your point is with respect to it being the same convening authority.
Well, it's an altogether when we're looking at a court martial through the eyes of the public, the public sees and who has the prosecutorial discretion in a case is the convening authority, and so the specific facts of this case are interesting to note that this convening authority from the first trial is the same one in the second trial. And so we have a situation where we have a company commander and one of his immediate subordinates, one of his company-level functionaries, is sitting on the same panel. And so it's raised by the appellant, but it's simply to point out the public perception of the fairness of the military justice system is equally strained when this fact is also known by the public. Ultimately, due to the military judge's denial of appellant's challenge for cause, there was a substantial risk that the public would feel that appellant's trial was not conducted with a fair and impartial panel. The military judge should have granted the challenge for cause due to the implied bias standard in light of this court's opinion in U.S. v. Veasan, and the facts that make the implied bias in this case more acute than U.S. v. Veasan. Also, Ultimately, the lower court erred by not applying the implied bias test to this challenge for cause, challenge at issue. As a result, this court should not give the military judge any deference. Ultimately, the appellant respectfully requests that this court reverse the lower court's decision and set aside the findings of guilty and sentence. There's no further question.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity to rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge, and may it please the court, I'd like to bring to the court's attention that this morning I filed a supplemental authority both in the United States versus Wiesen. There was a motion to reconsider that was denied. However, it was beyond just a mere denial. There were some substantive matters set forth in that opinion by this court. The second is United States versus Jefferson, which held that this court is reluctant to apply the implied bias challenge as a matter of law. Although this case turns upon one issue, and that is whether or not the judge abuses discretion, there are two other issues that I would invite the court's attention to, and perhaps it is an opportunity to clarify some of the implied bias analysis that this court has held in the past. The specified issue deals with the abuse of discretion, and this court should hold that when the appellant makes an implied bias challenge, he should, one, identify to the court that he is making an implied bias challenge, and two, it is his burden, as per 912, to place on the record sufficient facts necessary to support the implied bias challenge. In this case, the appellant has failed to do so, and the implied bias challenge should not apply.
Counsel, to pursue some of the questions that were raised earlier, are there any statements that were made by the defense in the area of that could be loosely described as judicial notice that you would cite to be inaccurate or inappropriate for this court to consider?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the fact that this court has struggled with the appellant counsel to determine what they can decide as judicially noticed, I think I don't know what a transportation and support company looks like in Third SSG. I have no idea how many people there are in that company. I don't think this court can take judicial notice of that. I don't think this court can take notice of the relationship, in this case, between the company gunnery sergeant and the CO. Whether there was a company first sergeant involved.
So this court's supposed to not have any knowledge about the military. We just dropped that. We parachute into the record. So if the reference was to an XO, we should say, I don't know what an XO is. Is this a football game or something?
Well, I think it's beyond that, sir. It's not just merely that there's an XO in the company. That's on the record. There was a company gunner sergeant.
So we're not supposed to know what an XO does on a ship, for example, unless there's testimony.
Well, I think what the appellant was trying to do was get into this special relationship or the relationship that existed between the company gunny in this case.
You mean the particular relationship?
Yes. Sir.
Okay. No. My question is, I understood the question in going, are we supposed to be aware of what the billet of company gunny is?
I think you can generically take judicial notice of that there's a company gunny in the company gunny structure, but what his exact duties and responsibilities are that pertain to
vis-a-vis that company commander.
Yeah, vis-a-vis
for you,
the
distinction is you're allowed to know that the XO on a ship is a second.
Yes.
In command.
Yes.
But you're not supposed to know whether they're good friends, bad friends, they get along well, or they whatever.
Well, merely because...
Is that a fair way of looking at it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, not only friends, but what the duties of...
I'm trying to take it out of this case to say
right.
that...
Well, I understand that,
people
sir.
Can argue the abstract without feeling they're losing anything.
I think this court can take judicial notice of the fact that COs use their personnel, whether it be the XO or the company gunny, in different ways. Some use the XO to do certain things, and some think the XO is a boob and sits him on the side and doesn't do anything with the guy. So
can we take judicial notice of that technical language?
Perhaps take judicial notice that some XOs are boobs.
Counsel,
sir.
For me, the question is, With respect to our role here in reviewing cases, the government and the defense frequently discuss aspects of military life and law without citing particular manuals, references, etc. Is there anything in this case that would preclude us from applying a general understanding of how the Marine Corps is organized, what a company typically consists of, and what the rank structure is within a company, and what a gunny sergeant particularly does with a relationship to those who are superior to him or her?
I think there's nothing that prevents this court from taking judicial notice of the general company structure and in the Marine Corps.
Anything that precludes us from understanding the relationship between gunny sergeants and others in a company?
As a general matter?
As a general matter.
You mean company gunnies?
Yeah.
No, I do not think so.
Okay, thank you.
But I don't think that answers the question in this case, and that is one of implied bias. I think that the burden is upon the appellant, if he wanted to explore that relationship and exactly what the relationship was between the company commander and the company gunning sergeants, he certainly was able to do that. But he failed to do that, and therefore he...
But aren't you arguing both sides of this equation? You're arguing here that we can't take judicial notice of this relationship between a captain and his gunnery sergeant. And yet, in your brief, you also argue that we can take judicial notice of the fact that this was a crusty old gunnery sergeant who is not going to listen to a young, wet-behind-the-ears captain. I mean, where is the difference in those two arguments?
Well, I think that was made in relationship to Wisen, where we tried to distinguish between the court structure in Wisen that had a very senior colonel, the brigade commander, along with his battalion commanders, three of them, and the various other folks that he wrote upon. In this case, where you have, and it's on the record, you have a captain who has only so much experience, and
But the impact of that experience is what you're asking us to take judicial notice of, essentially.
Yes, sir. I don't know if judicial notice is probably the right word, but again, the burden is not upon us to dispel the implied bias. The burden is upon the appellant to raise the issue and put the facts sufficient on the record. Make no inferences, I think, is probably the appropriate thing in this case, just what is on the record.
In the context of a case arising in the military service where this issue is raised, in which you have military judges, not civilian judges, presiding over the hearing, why is the description of the relationship that the defense put forward in this case insufficient to bring to the attention of the judge the issue of implied bias?
Because all you have on the record is really just a couple of facts. One, there's a reporting relationship between the captain and the gunnery sergeant. Two, they both received the standard instruction and both agreed that they would not let either rank or position influence the deliberation. Three, you had the captain who said he would not do that, he would not feel undermined if the gunnery sergeant had an opinion different than him in the deliberation room. Four, you had the company gunnery sergeant Ralston, say he would not feel intimidated, and I'm paraphrasing, that if his opinion was different than the captain's. And five, you had the relationship that existed, that one was the company commander and one was the gunnery sergeant. That's all that the record reflects about.
And my question is not whether the defense of the government should win based upon those facts, but why aren't those facts sufficient to bring to the attention of the military judge all that is then embodied in the description of the individuals who are involved? Shouldn't we approach this from the presumption, which I would think the government in many other contexts would want us to take, that the military judge has a good understanding of those relationships within the Marine Corps?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think the burden is upon the appellant, and here the appellant drove those questions toward a particular aspect of his challenge. And that was, specifically when they brought him back on individual voir dire, the conversations that the member, Captain Stroika, had with the convening authority over military justice matters. And again, they brought Gunnery Sergeant Walston back to see if he's been exposed to that. So it was in that context that the challenge was framed. It was merely beyond that that when asked about challenges, the defense said, oh, he writes on them, oh, and by the way, all this other stuff about the contact that he had with the convening authority. So the defense really drove the train in that direction. Now, the government does not disagree that this court cannot and should not apply its general knowledge of how the structure works. What the government has a problem with is inferring any special relationship that may have existed between these two particular individuals, that a company gunny is in some manner a position of trust within the military in general. Okay, maybe that could be judicially noted, but it cannot be infused to determine this case as to these particular folks. So I would think that the burden lies upon the appellant to determine what the relationship was.
So in your view, the issue that was raised in Wiesen was not even raised in this case to the military judge?
Oh, we would agree. It's our opinion that the defense did not carry its burden in establishing facts and the subtle influences that existed in Wiesen. This court in some...
My question wasn't whether the defense should prevail under Wiesen. The question is whether the defense raised enough to create a situation in which it was incumbent upon the military judge to give findings and conclusions as to why that challenge would not be granted.
Not with respect to the rating relationship. The judge in this case, as you're well aware, did apply the liberal right. cause mandate and put his rationale on the record pertaining to the contact that this Captain Stroika had with the convening authority. But just by recognizing the liberal court, the liberal grant mandate, deference, that's a clear signal that this court has required in order to determine whether or not he's
going to have deference. But in other words, he doesn't have to say anything about it. All he has to do is say the magic words.
Well, I don't think this court has ever...
The military judge said nothing about the superior-subordinate relationship, and we're now here arguing about it.
Yes.
And because he said nothing, what does that say to the amount of the amount of deference we give that? I think you're saying that the defense didn't put enough in to trigger a requirement that he say anything about it. Is that what you're saying?
I believe, yes, if that was unclear with regard to the rating
relationship. That the issue wasn't even really raised, and therefore his silence on the matter doesn't matter.
Correct.
Is that what the government is saying?
Yes, that with regard to the rating relationship.
That's right.
There was not sufficient facts put on the record that the defense met its burden.
So therefore his silence on the matter should not affect the amount of deference we give him.
Absolutely not. That's correct. But it does show what this case does establish is that and all that's demanded by this court is that that there be a clear signal that the military judge applied the correct law. And here, part of the correct law was the liberal grant mandate. And he did that not only in this case, but with the other captain who was exposed to the prior court-martial. He invoked what in essence was a liberal grant mandate, and sua sponte excused her from participation on the panel.
Was the military judge aware that Walston was the company gunny?
There's no evidence on the record that that was the case, except that
so are you saying that the record indicates that the military judge was not advised that he was the company gunny?
I think that was he advised? There's nothing on the record to show that the military judge knew that he was the company gunny, except that, as you know, it was found in the members' questionnaire. But that was never brought forth by either.
Did the judge have access to the members' questionnaires?
One would assume so, yes. The government would also like to invite this court's attention, if there are no further questions regarding the relationship, to the dicta in United States versus Clay. And that is when, and the government's position ties directly into this case, because prior to Clay, this court's analysis on implied bias has been, it is rarely invoked. And in that sense, this court, especially United States versus Rome and some of the cases cited by that case, it has truly been the situation where this court has been reluctant, United States versus Jefferson, to apply the implied bias standard, except in exceptional circumstances. The government would just ask this court to, again, invite this court's attention to Clay and how Clay seemed to broaden that analysis. And we would ask that the court look at that and perhaps clarify for the field whether or not this implied bias standard is going to be rarely invoked, or whether there's been a transition in the implied bias analysis.
Does the government have any problem with the holding in Wiesen or Wiesen, as you say? Is there something we should be doing with that, or is it something that you're comfortable with?
I think the holding in Wiesen should be narrowly construed. The premise of Wiesen was twofold. One, there's no per se exclusion for a superior subordinate relationship when it affects a certain ratio of the members. But two, the court relied upon these so-called subtle influences that exist within the military structure. And really took, if nothing else, judicial notice of those subtle influences. So do we have a problem with Wiesen? Yes, to the extent that these subtle influences weren't exactly laid out, but they should be restricted to just those situations, especially a situation where you have a very senior officer with his immediate subordinates, all of whom could be competing for.
So you want Wiesen restricted to its facts?
Yes, sir. That would be the government's position.
Okay.
You're perfectly happy with the ruling as long as it only applies to a brigade commander with the six subordinates on Tuesdays.
Well, and who the appellant's name is Wiesen, sir.
Yeah.
I would just like to bring to the court's attention that the judge did, as best he could, follow the mandates that were set down in this court, apply the liberal grant mandate to this. And I don't think, to get back to your question, Justice Stuckey, Judge Stuckey, I don't think it's necessary, and this court has never held, that if I make five challenges for, you know, a challenge for cause against a member based upon five bases, the judge has to go through and say, okay, with regard to challenge one, I recognize a liberal grant mandate. With regard to challenge two, I recognize a liberal grant mandate. Rather, it's a whole setting. And he did apply that, and he should be given discretion.
Assuming the military judge got it right the first time, once the peremptory challenge was made and the panel fell to three, it's your position that the military judge was under no sua sponte duty to re-examine that situation?
No, that is correct. It would be up to the 912 is pretty clear on it. The burden is upon the party making the challenge. So
changed circumstances don't make any difference in the ebb and flow of voir dire?
Not in this case. I imagine one could come up with a scenario where it would make a difference. But not in this case, especially given the fact that the defense didn't drive home the fact that he had a special relationship between the company gunner and the CO. If there are no further questions, that concludes the government's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
No, Your
Honor. That then concludes the case. It's now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. And the court will stand in recess until 2 p.m. this afternoon, when we shall convene for a special session in honor of our late colleague, the Honorable Robinson O. Everett. Court is now adjourned.
All rise.